phone a friend became the first of its kind in Australia, a self-help phone helpline where the rainbow community could support each other.
And we would yell out just at the door, out of the bars, into the street. And we had to do it quickly because the bar owners, they hated us. The only thing we could think of and what we did, linked arms and started chanting, stop police attacks on gays, women and blacks. Work in solidarity and let your voices be heard. Silence is not an option.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Brian DeShazer. The UK Supreme Court decides that transgender women are not always women. The US removes gender dysphoria from the list of protected disabilities, and Australia's Peter DeWall chronicles the road to liberation. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Lucia Chappell.
And I'm Marcos Najera.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending April 19th, 2025. Transgender women in the United Kingdom are not always women. That's how the Supreme Court ruled on April 16th. The unanimous decision of the High Court rejected the Scottish government's argument that trans women who have obtained a gender recognition certificate should be viewed as women with full access to women's services. That included trans women being covered under the same statutes that protect women from discrimination. One such statute is the UK's Equality Act 2010. The anti-trans group For Women Scotland demanded clarification of the terms women and sex in the Act. A lower court determined that the definition of sex was not limited to biology. Scotland's gender recognition certificates were created in 2004 to allow recipients to change their official gender for all purposes. The particular purpose that peeved For Women Scotland was the inclusion of transgender women on public sector boards where gender balance is required. For Women Scotland's suit argued that the terms sex and women in the Equality Act strictly refer to gender assigned at birth, which it calls an immutable biological state. The Supreme Court agreed, writing that the concept of sex is binary. A person is either a woman or a man. The ruling, therefore, makes intersex and non-binary people unsexed and non-existent. As the suit's anti-trans backers cheered, Judge Patrick Hodge cautioned, "We counsel against reading this judgment as a triumph of one or more groups in our society at the expense of another. It is not." Speaking for the five-judge panel, Hodge said, "The Equality Act 2010 gives transgender people protection not only against discrimination through the protected characteristic of gender reassignment, but also against direct discrimination, indirect discrimination, and harassment in substance in their acquired gender." Scottish trans leader Vic Valentine joined a chorus of activists and advocacy groups to denounce the court ruling. Opponents insist that its impact on access to sex-segregated public bathrooms, changing rooms, and the like must be resolved. In Valentine's words, "This judgment seems to suggest that there will be times when trans people can be excluded from both men's and women's spaces and services. It is hard to understand where we would then be expected to go, or how this decision is compatible with a society that is fair and equal for everybody." The Edinburgh-based group Scottish Trans is urging its constituents not to panic. Their reassuring Blue Sky post said, "There will be lots of commentary coming out quickly that is likely to deliberately overstate the impact that this decision is going to have on all trans people's lives." Scottish First Minister John Swinney once said that he believes transgender women are women. The leader of the ruling centre-left Scottish National Party now only promises that the government will engage on the implications of the High Court ruling. The Supreme Court ruling can be appealed.
Gender dysphoria is no longer covered by U.S. laws banning discrimination against people with disabilities. Although gender dysphoria is included in the preamble to the Rehabilitation Act, it's not specifically discussed in the text of the act that addresses rights of the disabled. Therefore, Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. declared this week that there are no anti-bias disability protections for many trans and non-binary people. 17 Republican state attorneys general are already suing the federal government over the Biden administration's specific addition of gender dysphoria to Section 504, where the classes protected by the Rehabilitation Act are described. It's unclear whether HHS Secretary Kennedy's announcement will make the current lawsuit against the inclusion of gender dysphoria moot, but a legal challenge to his edict is inevitable.
Norway should offer asylum to transgender people from the United States, according to a Green Party politician. Karina Erdeger is currently running to become the first out transgender member of the Norwegian parliament. Erdeger compared the plight of trans people under President Donald Trump to that of LGBTQ people in Nazi Germany. She asked, "What would we have done in the 1930s if we knew what was about to happen? That's where we are now. Then we must act." During an interview with the Norwegian news outlet Aftenposten, Erdeger said, "When we see developments in the United States where rights are being withdrawn through pure legal and political persecution, I believe it should provide grounds for asylum." Trans Norwegians enjoy several legal protections. They can legally change their gender by simply sending a notification to the National Population Register. Norway is one of the European countries that have issued formal travel alerts for its U.S.-bound gender nonconforming citizens, warning that the United States only recognizes the applicant's gender at birth. They urge trans and non-binary travelers to check first with the U.S. Embassy before departure.
LGBTQ Pride is now banned in Hungary. Parliament passed the bill on April 14th, but it was a foregone conclusion when the authoritarian government of Prime Minister Viktor Orban proposed it earlier this year. The Hungarian autocrat posted on social media, "We won't let woke ideology endanger our kids." Law enforcement can use facial recognition tools to identify anyone who attends a now-banned Pride event. The fine is up to 200,000 forints, about $550. Hungarians have not taken the government's violation of the freedom of assembly lying down. Tens of thousands of people have been hitting the streets of Budapest and in other cities in protest. An April 12th Gray Pride march at the Hungarian capital satirized the ban. Gray and black-clad participants waved monochrome flags in mock celebration of sameness. Budapest Pride organizers call the constitutional amendment not child protection. This is fascism. They intend to defy the ban and hold the annual event in late June.
Finally, Angela Thorpe Mason saw the Trump administration writing on the wall.
I first caught wind of this happening with the changes that were made to the Stonewall National Monument website. And so I figured something was probably going to come down the pipeline to the Pauli Murray Center.
Mason is the executive director of Durham, North Carolina's Pauli Murray Center for History and Social Justice, speaking with This Way Out the week of March 21st. Last week, the center was notified that the Federal Institute for Museum and Library Services was terminating its multi-year grant of close to $331,000. The institute itself is targeted for closure. The letter to the Murray Center stated that the grant no longer serves the interest of the United States. Mason responded, "The notion that Reverend Dr. Pauli Murray's lived experience as a Southerner and work as a black, gender nonconforming civil women's and human rights activist is against national interest is essentially un-American." A legal scholar and ordained Episcopal priest, biographers consider Pauli Murray to have identified as transgender long before the concept even entered public discourse. The Trump administration removed online references to Murray's gender identity earlier this year on the center's federal U.S. National Park Service website. The words queer and transgender disappeared from the webpage for the Pauli Murray family home in Durham. Mason told WUNC that the grant represented 20% of the center's current fiscal year's budget and nearly a quarter of next year's budget. It funded one of only five full-time staff, a loss Mason says has a major impact on both our work and our financial realities. Some community programs and a new exhibition will now be impossible. Mason told the Raleigh News and Observer that the center is hoping that alternative forms of giving will make up for the loss of federal funding. In her words, the funding cut only signals that our work is important again if a small site like ours is being attacked so violently.
That's NewsWrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending April 19th, 2025. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap is written by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappell, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Marcos Najera. Stay healthy.
And I'm Lucia Chappell. Stay safe.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
Survivors of the generation that started the LGBTQ plus movement in Australia are like gold, and mining the life story of Peter de Waal is a rich pursuit. Born in the Netherlands, de Waal in the early 1970s was a founding member of the Sydney organization Campaign Against Moral Persecution, or CAMP. He was there for Australia's Stonewall at the first gay and lesbian Mardi Gras and was still on the front lines for the marriage equality struggle. This Way Out's Barry McKay joined the throng for the March 24th launch of de Waal's amazing memoir, held at Balmain Town Hall, home of the first CAMP events.
So, Peter de Waal, you're having your book launch today.
Indeed.
It's called It Wasn't Dutch Courage. Can you tell me a little bit about your life story?
It's been very long, diverse. There's been lots of ups and downs. I've had lots of childhood traumas because of the war, but I've been able to turn that into courage and resilience, and I've been able to help the community have better lives.
So you were born in The Hague?
Yes, 1938.
And you came to Australia in the
50s? 1957,
I arrived. And then you met a special person called Bon.
That was in 1966 we
and
met.
And you lived together all your life?
Yes. For more than 50 years we had.
And what were your memories of the late 60s and the early 70s?
Basically, life was filled with fear, oppression. Life was terribly hard.
And you were one of the first people to set up the gay counselling telephone services.
Well, we were. My partner and I, we set up the phone service in our front room.
Here Peter reads from his book about the establishment of that phone service.
In the face of exclusion from Methodist-run Lifeline and our own avalanche of phone calls in Balmain, a recent camp, the Campaign Against Moral Persecution, which paved the way for Australia's nationwide rainbow community, a recruit by the name of Krista Stahl, suggested a life-changing idea. Together, we founded Phone a Friend, a pioneering self-help service for homosexuals by homosexuals, modelled on one he had established in Sweden. It emerged from deep-seated necessity, an initiative born of desperation, but which carried the promise of empowerment. Initially, Bon and I said, "Oh yes, please help us." But the next questions were, how and where could it be based? Christa said, "Well, you have a front room, let's start it there. I'll start to organize volunteers." Phone a Friend became the first of its kind in Australia, a self-help phone helpline where the rainbow community could support each other through shared experiences and understanding. Care delivered by those who knew firsthand the nuances of our needs. On 13 April 1973, now 52 years ago, Bon and I proudly disseminated a press release on behalf of Camp New South Wales, announcing the launch of this audacious new venture. We hand-delivered the news far and wide, echoing the traditional paperboy's run. The announcement was also made in Camp Inc., where a modestly sized advertisement made the pointed commentary on Methodist Lifeline failure to embrace rainbow people. The tagline, "Gay Love Needs Gay Care," was in our minds a heartening call to action, a clear message that the people at Phone a Friend were there to care and to stay. Next, a further Phone a Friend promotional campaign was organized, Stickers. It was a genius and simple idea that would simultaneously provide much-needed consciousness raising. The message on small green adhesive stickers was, "Homosexuals demand equality," with a tagline, "Camp, Gay Liberation, Care of Phone a Friend, A24023 Sydney, our home number." It was what we would now call guerrilla activism, with both a political message and an avenue for people to seek connection or support. We organized nighttime green sticker roving squads, roaming suburbs, spreading stickers far and wide on public toilet cubicles, urinals at eye level, bus stops, lampposts, billboards, you name it. Thousands of Phone a Friend advertisements became features of Sydney streetscapes. For several years, they were visible liberation markers, and Phone a Friend's single landline ran red hot.
And in 1972, you were the first two gay males to kiss on national television.
Australian national television.
That's quite a result.
It was.
Here's an excerpt from that groundbreaking 1972 TV documentary called Checkerboard, This Just Happens to Be Part of Me, where Peter Duval and his partner Peter Bonsall Boone, or Bon, are interviewed at home. The entire documentary is on YouTube.
How long have you two been living together?
5 years since we first moved together. We've known each other for 6 years.
How did you meet?
We were introduced by a friend who met Peter first and was already a friend of mine.
And what attracted you to Peter in the beginning?
I don't know. It just went bang.
Right away? Mutually?
No, it took me much longer. It took me about 3 or 4 months before I, you know, really made up my mind that Peter was the person I wanted to share my life with.
What attracted you to Bonsall in the first place?
Oh, dear. I just felt attracted to him, and my love for him just grew bigger and bigger.
What was the backlash from that?
Horrible, horrible, because my partner got the sack.
What happened to Bond?
He got the sack. He was a church secretary doing the administration. It took forever for him to get a job then. Yeah.
Peter recalls his involvement in Sydney's 1978 Mardi Gras, Australia's Stonewall.
It was an amazing experience to be on the street, it was like reclaiming the night, because in those days, Oxford Street was like a small gay Mecca. So the beginning of it was just euphoric. It was liberating. And I was one of those. There were many bars in those days in Oxford Street. And in order to try and make the parade grow, I was one of those and a few others who darted into the bars. And we would, you know, yell out just at the door, out of the bars, into the street. And because we had to do it quickly, because the bar owners, they hated us, because we took away their clientele, or tried to. And then we got to the bottom of Oxford Street, and then the horrendous, awful police intervention started. It was near the El Alamein fountain. Behind it, there was a group, many, many police. They'd taken their badges off. So they basically let us in. And then once we were in that area, they closed us off behind. And then the bashings and the riots. And
were you bashed?
No, I wasn't. No, fortunately. But I saw it happening, and it was like a war. It's the police who instigated. We were peaceful. We were chanting, singing. And there was a huge amount of fear because the police used their truncheons. They picked people up by their hair, threw them into paddy wagons, and they weren't quite inside, and they would shove the doors. Some people were really quite hurt. The only thing we could think of and what we did, linked arms and started chanting, stop police attacks on gays, women and blacks. In a sense, it was a wonderful thing to do. There was like this huge sense of solidarity. Intellectually, I'd understood what oppression was, but I'd never understood it in a physical sense. They took 55 into Darlinghurst station, and Peter Murphy, they nearly killed him in a cell. Two police thugs kept beating him, kicking him, and then it took 5 hours before they allowed him to be taken to a hospital.
After the 78 Mardi Gras, how did that spur you on to become more involved with activism?
I think it galvanized that fear, that real deep sense of oppression. I think it activated us. Out of that fear grew a sense of, we've got to do something. We are human beings. We're honest people. We're good people.
Going forward many years.
Journalist William Broome.
One of the big campaigns that you were involved in was marriage equality here in Australia. What are your memories and how did you become involved?
Bon and I became involved because, for two reasons. Of course, personally, we wanted to get married. Secondly, we felt, as we had felt with many issues over the 50 years we were both involved in activism in the community, that this was a really good thing for the community to have. To feel that they're equal and to have the same rights as opposite sex partners.
In 2017, at the age of 78, Bon had been diagnosed with terminal cancer and his time was running out.
During the 2017 Australian Marriage Equality Campaign, on one of my sleepless nights, I thought I'd write a personal plea to Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull. Dear Mr. Turnbull, you can make our wish come true, but please do it quickly, as Bond's time is fast running out. I attached a plea to a long and detailed Sydney Morning Herald article entitled Dying Man's Desperate Wedding Wish by Michael Koziol, published 9 April 2017. Next, I faxed, posted, and emailed it to Malcolm Turnbull's Canberra Parliamentary Office and his Sydney Electoral Office. Australian Federal Green Senator Janet Rice hand-delivered our personal plea to Malcolm Turnbull's Parliamentary Office in Canberra as well. She also was the only federal parliamentarian who spoke about our plea in the Senate. In other words, no stone was left unturned. T to make sure that our plea reached Turnbull. Deeply disappointed by Turnbull's cold inattention, sadly, not even a simple acknowledgement came in response to our heartfelt plea for help.
In 2017, Bond passed away. You didn't take a back seat. You didn't step back. You got very much involved, particularly with marriage equality. You were at rallies. You were at events. Do you think in some ways Bond's death made you even more determined to campaign?
It did make me more determined, but it also was a way of dealing with the loss and grief I was suffering. By being still involved in the campaign, I kept meeting people and I felt I was able to contribute to the community. So in a peculiar sort of way, it was a of dealing with my grief and loss.
So looking at the world today and looking at what's happening in the United States, what comments would you have?
I'm very frightened. I think it's not only the United States, you know. This rollback of rights has been happening in Europe already. Hungary is one of them. Like the Netherlands, one of the most progressive countries, or it used to be, they've got a coalition of right-wing governments. And the issues are being rolled back. It is not just the US. The USA is actually late in getting it. It is like a tidal wave rolling from Europe through the United States, and some of it is now likely to come to Australia. I hope not, but yeah.
What would be your advice or your final words to an international audience?
Stand together, work together. Work in solidarity and let your voices be heard. Silence is not an option. That's what happened in 1930 with the Nazis. There were too many people who kept silent. Later on, they regretted it. So what I'm saying is we can't be silent now. We must speak up and, yeah.
Peter Duval, congratulations on the launch of your book. How can people overseas get copies of your book?
It will be available on Amazon. Mm-hmm. It's called It Wasn't Dutch Courage.
It Wasn't Dutch Courage by Peter Duval. That's Peter, D-E-W-A-A-L.
That's correct.
Okay, congratulations,
thank
Peter.
You.
And thank you for being on This Way Out.
Okay, thank you.
Cheers.
Barry Mackay, This Way Out, Sydney, Australia.
Thanks for finding This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. NewsWrap was reported this week by Lucia Chappell and Marcos Najera, with thanks to David Hunt, and produced by Brian DeShazer. Our correspondent was Barry McKay, with additional material by William Broom. The Ides of March and the Sydney Gay and Lesbian Choir performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks Harry Richardson of Socorro, New Mexico, and Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley. Listener donors make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078 USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon, associate producer Lucia Chappell, and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Brian DeShazer. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And on WRWK, Midlothian, Virginia, 3CR, Fitzroy, Victoria, KPNW, Bellingham, Washington, and a wide array of community, terrestrial, and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned.